content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. And our first story today is entitled, You Don't Know Yourself as Well as You Think You Do, and That's Okay, by Julie Beck. Know thyself. Many have said this. Socrates. Maybe you've heard of him? Though he seems to have gotten the phrase from the oracle at Apollo's temple in Delphi, where it was chiseled into the stone facade. In the Tao Te Ching, Lao Tzu wrote, If you understand others, you are smart. If you understand yourself, you are illuminated. And Shakespeare had his own pithy aphorism, To thine own self be true, presupposing that thou knowest enough about thine own self to be true to it. Good advice to a point. If you know absolutely nothing about yourself or your likes, wants, values, or personality, you either are a baby or have bigger problems than a dead philosopher can address. Yet sometimes all of modern life seems to be pushing people toward knowing themselves in more and more granular ways. People are going to therapy in rising numbers to seek self-understanding. They are tracking their steps, reading, and sleep. They are giving their data to corporate marketing databases so they can find out their Myers-Briggs type, Enneagram number, or Harry Potter house. On TikTok, as Rebecca Jennings reported for Vox, creators are inventing new micro-identities for people to resonate with. Dilly-dalliers are people who like to fart around and waste time. A therapist friend is someone whose friends talk to them about their problems. The quest to find and define yourself can feel never-ending. It can also feel like a vital part of life, as though if you're not seeking self-understanding, you're missing out. Our old pal Socrates also said, the unexamined life is not worth living. If you haven't noticed how pervasive this message is in society, just pay attention for the next few days, Rebecca Schlegel, a Texas A&M University school psychologist told me. It's so baked into our culture that we almost take it for granted. But the dream of perfect self-knowledge is unattainable, and chasing it too doggedly can leave you more confused and stuck than when you started. Humans' ability to see themselves clearly and accurately has limitations that neither personality quizzes nor Fitbit data can overcome. We should never think that we know ourselves very well, Simon Vazir, a University of Melbourne psychology professor who has studied self-knowledge, told me. Anyone who thinks they do, by definition, they lack self-knowledge, because they're wrong about that, at least. Knowing yourself is difficult in part because some behaviors and attitudes stem from the unconscious mind, outside your sphere of awareness. The mind purrs along under the hood in various ways, Timothy Wilson, a University of Virginia psychologist and the author of Strangers to Ourselves, told me. One of many examples he gives in his book is how people interpret ambiguous situations and why. If I tell a joke at a party and no one laughs, my unconscious patterns will determine whether I think I'm a socially awkward fool whom everyone hates, or assume that my audience must not have heard me over the din of the party, because I'm clearly charming and hilarious. Bias is also a hindrance. For example, many people have a tendency to rate themselves as better than average across all kinds of traits, even though, obviously, we can't all be above average. Biases are part of the problem with a personality quiz, Vazir told me. Far from revealing some hidden truth that was locked within, she said, the test is just repeating to you what you tell it. Another tricky thing is that most people aren't fully aware of how much capacity they have for change. A study of 19,000 people that Wilson worked on, called The End of History Illusion, found that although people reported having changed a lot in the past decade, on average they believed they were mostly done changing and it wouldn't evolve much more in the next 10 years. The pursuit of self-knowledge is difficult even when someone goes about it in a thoughtful, deliberate way. Meditating, journaling, or asking yourself the hard questions can be greatly beneficial. But active, conscious introspective has a dark side. Rumination, or getting fixated on a problem and going over it again and again, which can make things worse and trap people in a negative thought spiral. People can also undermine themselves by thinking too much about the good things in their lives. In a small study Wilson conducted, when the researchers asked people to reflect on how their romantic relationship was going, the very act of reflecting seemed to change the subjects' minds. Some got happier with their relationship, some got less happy. But according to Wilson, these changes in perspective didn't necessarily reflect people's true feelings. Love is not fully explainable, after all, and Wilson theorized that the subjects put too much stock in whatever answers they came up with for the study. If they struggled to list a lot of good reasons they loved their significant other, they might conclude that they were less in love than they thought. People sometimes construct a new story about their feelings based on the reasons that happen to come to mind, Wilson wrote. Introspection, as he described in his book, should be understood less as an archaeological dig to uncover the capital T truth of ourselves, and more as literary criticism, in which we are the text to be understood. Just as a good novel doesn't have one single truth in it, a person has many truths as well. Rather than seeking a perfectly accurate story about themselves, which is impossible, people should try to construct a narrative that's pretty positive and somewhat reality-based, according to Wilson. This is one way to think about therapy, as a collaborative process of rewriting your story until it works well enough to let you stop thinking about it quite so much. The notion that each person has one real, abiding self buried within, waiting to be discovered, is both widespread and difficult for many people to shake, Schlegel told me. When people go through a big change, for instance, particularly a good one, they tend to think of it less as a transformation from one thing to another, and more as a discovery of something in themselves that was always there. Schlegel has found that belief in the true self is linked to seeing greater meaning in your life, but she described herself as a true self agnostic. She referenced the social psychologist Roy Baumeister, who called the true self a, quote, troublesome myth, end quote. For all the idea's benefits, the downside, she said, is what happens if we close ourselves off to change, and then we miss out on something we might have loved. Most of my life, I thought I was a dog person who hated running. Yet, just a couple of weekends ago, I ran a 5K, then came home to my two perfect cats, Cherry and Ginkgo, whom I am utterly devoted to. If you had beamed a premonition of that Saturday into my mind of my younger self, she would have been confused, perhaps even alarmed. My preference for dogs and my disdain for running were two things I thought I would never change my mind about. But that might have been just a failure of imagination. As Wilson and his co-authors wrote in their End of History Illusion study, people may confuse the difficulty of imagining personal change with the unlikelihood of change itself. Why did I change my mind? On the running, I really have no idea. I just got on the treadmill one day for some reason and found it to be not so bad. My husband wanted the cats, and I fell in love the day he brought them home as tiny kittens. Was I always a cat person, secretly? Did I have an inner runner within me, just waiting to be discovered? Did I actually change, or did I become more myself? I don't know, and I don't really care. Both explanations seem plausible, and I ended up in the same place either way. Watching Survivor on the treadmill every now and then, and being woken up every morning at 6 a.m. by a scratchy little tongue licking my face. Vazir, like me, runs very casually once in a while. She told me that her well-meaning partner sometimes shares things he's learned about how to improve your form or otherwise optimize your running, and she gets annoyed. I'm not trying to optimize anything, she said. I'm not trying to become a runner. I wouldn't consider myself a runner either. I just run sometimes. Not every habit or preference has to become an identity. Sometimes we just do things. As Schlegel put it, not everything has to become so weighty. Instead of conceiving our true self as set in stone, the secret to a healthy pursuit of self-knowledge may lie in building a flexible sense of self, one that allows for surprise and even mystery. Research has linked the belief that the self is changeable to positive outcomes, lower stress, better physical health, and less negative reactions to hardships. Maybe we should stop searching for ourselves quite so intensely, put down the sorting hat and the label maker, and just, I don't know, live life and try things without overly worrying about what they say about who we really are. To be found, to be known. These are unreachable destinations. Not only is our ability to know ourselves limited, but scientists can probably only know so much about the nature of self-knowledge. Vazir is highly skeptical that research can solve that puzzle. I don't think the expertise we need here is quantitative empirical data, she said. It's just wisdom, or something like that. Parts of the self will probably always remain a little lost, hesitant to easy categorization, and maybe that's fine. I am a cat person now, though. Our second article, Humanity Can Quit Fossil Fuels But Not Food, by Michael Grunwald. Imagine that humanity quit fossil fuels. Think of our entire Ozymandian blob of a global economy running on clean energy instead of ancient heat-trapping hydrocarbons. More than 1 billion vehicles, 2 billion homes, every school, mall, skyscraper, data center, airport, seaport, factory, and cryptocurrency on Earth. No more gas stoves, gas stations, or gas-fired power plants. No more petrochemicals, petrostates, or petroleum jelly. Even as a thought experiment, it's almost unimaginable. Fossil energy is so ubiquitous, so useful, so entrenched. The President of the United States is shredding regulations to get Americans to produce and consume even more of it. But radical change always seems unimaginable before it happens. And in recent years, the absurd fantasy of fossil-free energy has gotten a bit less absurd. America's coal power has declined by more than half since 2010, while wind power has more than tripled. Solar capacity has expanded 40-fold, and more than 4 million electric vehicles have appeared on the road. Globally, most new electricity is zero emissions, because clean is now usually cheaper than dirty. Fossil fuels still energize most of the planet, so the transition away from them will take years, but it has begun. And Donald Trump can't stop it. We can now start to see how the fossil fuel story will end, even if we don't know when it will end. The thing is, fossil fuels are only 2/3 of the climate problem. Even if we do quit them, we'll never meet the emissions targets set by the Paris Agreement, without addressing the other third. The challenge is food. What we eat, how we produce it, and the forests and other natural ecosystems we keep clearing to make room for more farms to make more food. And that's mostly a land story about the relentless spread of crops and pastures that already cover 2 of every 5 acres of land on Earth, obliterating the wild landscapes that soak up carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. We have no idea how or when that story will end. Humanity's dominion over the Earth isn't really about the spread of cities and towns, highways and driveways, industry and commerce. It's about farming. Of all the planet's land that isn't ice or desert, barely 1% of it is developed. Half is cropped or grazed. Urban sprawl is a rounding error compared with agricultural sprawl. Look out the window on a cross-country flight. The land people use to live, learn, work, and play is dwarfed by the land used to make food. Agriculture's footprint is already larger than Asia, and the more it expands, the more nature's footprint shrinks, expelling the carbon stored in its soil and vegetation into the overheated atmosphere. Somehow we'll need to get the limited land on our hot and hungry planet to produce much more food to sustain us and absorb much more carbon to save us, because it will be impossible to decarbonize the atmosphere if we keep vaporizing trees. It's like trying to clean the house while smashing the vacuum cleaner to bits in the living room. And not only is the conversion of natural land into farmland and rangeland the leading driver of deforestation, agriculture is responsible for much of the world's water shortages, water pollution, wetland destruction, and biodiversity loss. It's propelling the worst extinction since an asteroid wiped out the dinosaurs 66 million years ago. Oh, and unlike the fossil fuel problem, this land problem is getting worse. That's partly because the number of people on Earth increases every day, while the amount of land on Earth does not. But it's also because those people are eating more meat, which means not only more methane emissions from cow burps and manure, but the use of more land to grow grass and grain for animals to eat before we eat them. More than 3/4 of the world's agricultural land now supports livestock. In the U.S., nearly half of that land is used to produce beef, which provides just 3% of U.S. calories. In other words, we're eating the earth. Agriculture is essential because food isn't optional. But the planet can't keep losing a soccer field's worth of tropical forest every 6 seconds. If current trends hold, the world's farmers will have to clear at least a dozen more California's worth of land to fill nearly 10 billion human bellies by 2050. That could wipe out the Amazon rainforest and other natural carbon storehouses that are not only refuges for wildlife, but our best defense against climate chaos. The math is daunting. Global agricultural production will need to expand about 50% by 2050, the caloric equivalent of a dozen extra Olive Garden breadsticks every day for everyone alive today, while the global agricultural footprint needs to shrink. Producing enough calories to nourish our growing population without chewing up the carbon sinks that stabilize our warming climate will be as monumental a challenge as ending oil. The rich world will need to eat less beef and more plants, while the entire world will need to produce more food with less land. That's going to get even harder as climate-driven droughts, floods, heat waves, and pest infestations drag down crop and livestock yields. The good news is that remarkable people are working on this eating the earth problem, and their work can be antidotes to climate fatalism. They're re-engineering soybean plants to grow dairy proteins. developing feed additives to help cattle burp less methane, restoring carbon-rich peatlands, upcycling food waste into snacks, and even improving the miracle of photosynthesis. They're growing super-efficient salmon in indoor tanks, super-efficient trees on barren land, and super-efficient crops genetically manipulated to survive droughts and floods. They're inventing biofertilizers that train microbes to fetch nutrients from the air and biopesticides that use RNA technology to constipate beetles to death. John Deere is preparing to roll out its first electric tractors, in green, naturally. But food and climate solutions are still about a quarter of a century behind energy and climate solutions. Less than 4% of the world's climate finance is flowing into the land sector, much of it toward farm-grown biofuels and low-yield agricultural approaches that would induce even more deforestation and emissions. There's a strange consensus among hippie foodie lefties who read Michael Pollan, all-natural biohacker bros who listen to Joe Rogan, and executives who run major agricultural businesses and philanthropies that answer lies in kinder and gentler alternatives to industrial farming. But the truth is that organic and grass-fed are usually worse for the climate than conventional and feedlot finished, mainly because they're less productive and more land-intensive. Meanwhile, all public agricultural research and development focused on the climate in the U.S. is a fraction of Apple's research and development, as if farming weren't nearly as important than as a better iPhone camera. Although the fossil fuel problem is now a mostly political story because we basically know what we need to do, the eating the earth problem is still an analytical story. We haven't yet figured out what we need to do, but we know it won't be easy. Making more food with less land will require new crops, new foods, new policies, and new behaviors. They won't be invented, approved, and adopted worldwide overnight. We'll have to make personal and political changes as unimaginable as quitting fossil fuels. And we can't quit food. Feeding the world without frying it is another absurd fantasy that eventually needs to become reality. This story has been excerpted from Michael Grunwald's forthcoming book entitled We Are Eating the Earth. Our third article, FEMA is Not Prepared, by David A. Graham. This is from the Atlantic Daily Newsletter of June the 3rd. Who manages the disaster if the disaster managers are the disaster? That's a question that the people of the United States may have to answer soon. As hurricane season begins in the U.S., the Federal Emergency Management Agency is in disarray. Reuters reported yesterday that acting FEMA head David Richardson suggested during a meeting with employees that he was unaware of the very existence of a hurricane season. A spokesperson for the Department of Homeland Security dismissed the report. Despite mean-spirited attempts to falsely frame a joke as policy, there is no uncertainty about what FEMA will be doing this hurricane season. The spokesman added, FEMA is shifting from bloated DC-centric deadweight to a lean, deployable disaster force that empowers state actors to provide relief for their citizens. FEMA employees and Americans at large might be forgiven for having doubts. Richardson has only been on the job since early May, when his predecessor was abruptly fired after telling Congress he did not believe that FEMA should be eliminated, as President Donald Trump has contemplated. Richardson is a Marine veteran who has been leading the DHS office that seeks to prevent attacks on the U.S. involving weapons of mass destruction. But he has no experience with disaster management. The Wall Street Journal reported that he had expressed surprise at how broad FEMA's remit is. The last time FEMA was led by an administrator whose profession was not emergency management was in the mid-2000s under Michael Brown. If you don't know how that turned out, I recommend my colleague Van R. Newkirk II's award-winning podcast on Hurricane Katrina, Floodlines. But Richardson surely is aware of hurricane season. In mid-May, CNN obtained an internal document warning that FEMA was badly behind schedule. As FEMA transforms to a smaller footprint, the intent for this hurricane season is not well understood. Thus, FEMA is not ready. To calm worries at the agency, Richardson held a conference call. "I would say we're about 80 to 85% there," he told staff, according to ABC News. "The next week we will close that gap and probably get to 97 or 98% of a plan. We'll never have 100% of a plan." That was not the most reassuring answer, and it looks worse now. The Journal reports that the same meeting yesterday, where Richardson suggested unfamiliarity with hurricane season, he also said the agency would return to its 2024 hurricane preparedness strategy. How that will work is anyone's guess, given that FEMA has already slashed programs and staff since last year's hurricane season. FEMA is not a large part of the federal government by budget or staff, but it is an important one because it directly affects the lives of ordinary Americans in their worst moments. Washington can seem distant and abstract, but disasters are not. And as Hurricane Helene last year demonstrated, even people living in supposed climate havens are susceptible to extreme weather. In the post-FEMA future that Trump has floated, states would be responsible for all disaster recovery. Some conservatives have long argued that states need to shoulder more responsibility for smaller disasters, but most states simply don't have the resources to respond to large-scale disasters like Helene. FEMA has not generally been a partisan agency. Administrators may have different political views, but they tried to provide help without consideration for politics. I've spoken with several administrators over the years, and they are consistently professional, don't take wildly differing approaches to their work, and are dedicated to emergency response. And yet, if FEMA isn't prepared for hurricane season, doesn't have sufficient staff, and is laboring under a president who would like to see it gone, the problem may not be only that the president's allies can get help from the federal government, but rather that no one can. That last article was edited in part because we've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.